Hello and welcome to the Roundhouse Podcast with Paul Sollentrop of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. Today we have Mike Kennedy, voice of the Shockers, and Bob Lutz, host of Bob and Jeff on Sports Radio KFH, former columnist for the Wichita Eagle. They're going to join us as we continue to remember the 2013 Shocker basketball season that ended in the Final Four in Atlanta. I'll remind people, those Shockers went 30-9. They finished second in the Missouri Valley Conference. They were seeded ninth. They beat eight-seeded Pittsburgh and number one Gonzaga, advanced to the Sweet 16, where they defeated LaSalle and Ohio State in Los Angeles. That sent them to the Final Four, where they lost to Louisville in the national semifinals. So you have both covered a lot of Shocker basketball together. You've seen almost all of the ups and downs dating back to the 1960s. So, Mike, let's start. Put that season, that 2012-13 season, into perspective for people. What did it mean to Wichita State basketball?
Well, first of all, it was a really good season. You mentioned they ended up 30-9, but second in the conference. I mean, it wasn't you didn't think of it going through as a particularly memorable season, and then they went on that run and made the Final Four, and I'm sure any of us, with what had happened in college athletics in terms of the Power Five emerging and those kinds of things, wondered if there was any chance that Wichita State would ever reach that kind of level again. And so I think it just showed everyone what's possible. It put a whole different perspective going forward on what Wichita State basketball could possibly be in any given year.
So, Bob, you have the great memories with your dad of going to, I guess, what was then the WU Fieldhouse, Stallworth, Bowman, Warren Armstrong, all those things. That's what you grew up on. That Final Four season in 2013, how do you put it in perspective for the history of Shocker basketball?
Well, I had them going to the Final Four after their loss to Evansville on the road. So I went to FanDuel and made that bet. Not really, because I don't think anybody could have seen this coming with this team. The thing about this team was you saw a bright future. You saw this team being the team that kind of was a stepping stone to being something really special, because you had these great freshmen and Baker and Van Vliet and Wessel, and you could see a bright future, but I don't think anybody could have foreseen a Final Four run with this particular team. But they got hot at the right time. They got fortunate in some ways. Their win over Gonzaga propelled them. That was certainly, in my view, the biggest win of this run, and maybe one of the two or three biggest wins in the history of Wichita State basketball, because I think that made these players, this was a pretty young team, I think it made them believe that anything was possible.
No question, they did go on a run. Professionally, chronicling that team, Mike is the play-by-play voice, Bob, columnist for the Eagle. What did it mean professionally to you, Mike, to be a part of that?
I have always said that my greatest thrill, my greatest moment in all the years that I've done Shocker sports was the baseball national championship in 1989, but this jumped up there right even with that pretty much. I will never forget sitting there with Bob and Dave as that game with Ohio State ended and we went to a break, and I'm looking back and forth at them and saying, we're going to the Final Four. Do you understand what's happening here? We're going to the frickin' Final Four. I mean, it just had that kind of surreal feel to it. It's I don't expect to maybe ever expect something like that again.
Yeah, my similar moment was typing those words. At some point, Wichita State is one win away from the Final Four, which unexpected. Bob, how about you? You saw a lot of Shocker basketball. Professionally, what was it like to be on that?
Well, we had an army of people at the Wichita Eagle in those days, and we put that together, and we sent that crew out on the road, and my son, Jeff, was a part of that, and to be able to cover that run of Wichita State basketball with him, and of course with you and several others from the newspaper, those were different days, and it's hard to believe that's only 10 years ago. We had, seven or eight people out on the road with that team.
Two photographers. Tony Adame, Fred Mann probably would have been
there. I don't know that Fred was there, but Rick Plumlee.
Rick Plumlee.
That certainly is a bygone era already in terms of just media coverage and newspaper coverage. So we got in under the wire to be able to do something like that, and to be able to staff that that run with so many people and all the creativity and all the stuff that went into that was a lot of fun.
I can also remember, I think we did like a 96-page preview for the Final Four, and at some point I remember thinking, what are we going to do if they make it to the championship game? How do you follow that up? So yeah, that was a lot of fun to bring that back, because the fans were so involved, and to feed their passion in my job and both of your job, that was a lot of fun.
You know, the other thing for me, I had never been to a Final Four, and haven't since. I mean, I'd never covered one for any reason, and just the scope of it was incredible to me. I've been to the College World Series, and I haven't been to a Super Bowl, but I mean, just the size and scope when you got there to Atlanta, and the arena itself, I swear, now it probably wasn't, but it felt like the walk from the media work area to the court might have been a mile or something. I mean, it was that big and that expansive, and it was just, what, probably 20-some thousand people there for those glorified shoot-arounds, the mandatory practices that they had in the arena, stuff like that, that it just was incredible to me.
Yeah, it was fun watching the players. I think they had that feeling multiplied walking out for the practice and seeing the dome and all of that stuff. All right, let's warm up for memory lane. I'll hit you with some trivia questions. We'll see how much you remember.
You got a guy here nicknamed Trivia.
I know.
You're going to put me in that.
We'll see.
Thanks a lot.
And I think I gave away one of these earlier before we were recording. Who started more games that season, Fred Van Vliet or Ahime Arupe?
Oh, it had to be Arupe. I don't know if Fred ever started a game that year.
So. Correct. Yes, Ahime started 30.
Was that his question?
That was for. I knew you weren't going to get that one, so I went right to Mike. Fred did not start a game that year. Yeah, his year maybe unfolded differently than what we think. He was kind of finding his way, and then obviously, you know, played a lot toward the end of the season.
If I may, there are just a couple of things that I'll always remember about that year with Fred. One was the first time we had him on a post-game interview. Star of the game. It was maybe the most incredible first interview with a freshman Dave and I had ever done. It was like you were talking to a 30-year-old assistant coach or something. And then another thing I remember about that year was watching him just warming up and in practice and so forth. You could tell he's a true point guard. He's going to be a really good point guard. But his shot was just average at best. And you thought, well, that's probably something, maybe he's not going to be much of a scorer, much of a shooter. And then as the year went on and you watched him warming up and stuff, his shot just kept looking better and better. And I finally said to one of the assistant coaches, I think Greg Heyer, I said, is it just me or is his shot getting better? And he said, oh, yeah. He said, we tweaked a couple of things technically when he got here, but in that he's in the gym on his own all the time working on it, and it's getting better and better. And then the other thing I remember goes hand in hand with everything he's accomplished. He'd come into a game sometimes early in the year and get burned. His guy would go by him or something, and you'd think, okay, that's something he's going to learn from, and he'll get better as we go through the year. The next time he came into the game, he'd been sitting there watching the guy and had figured out how to stay in front of him or do whatever he needed to do. I don't think I've ever seen a kid that young make those kinds of adjustments like this.
A lot of great Fred stories from that season, from his career, and certainly a big part of that would be as he got better, he and Malcolm Armstead were able to play together a lot late in the season, and that was very helpful for that team. Which Missouri Valley Conference opponent went 2-0 versus the Shockers? Bob, I'll let you handle that one.
Well, I got the sheet, but I'm not going to look at it.
Okay.
I'll say Creighton.
No, they beat the Shockers twice, but did not go 2-0.
Evansville.
That's what I should have said.
Yeah, I'm surprised you missed that one. Evansville was a well-known thorn in the Shockers' side.
They were one of the games on that three-game losing streak in midseason, and then one senior night, which prompted Greg Marshall to never allow senior night ceremonies before a game again. He said guys were crying, and it was just, you know, they ended up losing a home game.
Yeah, and it cost them the Valley Championship, or a share of the Valley Championship, on Greg's 50th birthday, if I'm remembering that correctly. That was quite the night. Okay, that was 2012-13 was the last season for the Bracket Busters series, which was a big deal. Missouri Valley Conference, Commissioner Doug Elgin, all that. Shockers easily defeated Detroit in the Bracket Busters game in late February. Wasn't particularly compelling. Who was the school, which was a Bracket Busters short-lived rival, that did play a significant role in the 2012-13 season? So a Bracket Busters connection, although it wasn't a Bracket Busters game. Bob?
You know this one?
I do.
Okay, Mike.
Of course he does.
VCU.
There
VCU,
you go.
Yes. They beat VCU early in the season. Malcolm Armstead jumper in the final seconds. That was a return game from 2011, which, of course, was famous because VCU won here in a close, hotly contested game, went on to the Final Four, and then they met in the 2012 NCAA tournament. VCU, big. That was a big deal then.
Yeah, they had won twice. You mentioned the game at Coker. Well, yeah, the game in the tournament in Portland. So VCU had beaten them twice, had another very good team, and that win on the road early in the season kind of said maybe this team's going to be something special.
And I think that was a big chip in the NCAA at large.
No doubt.
When the Shockers made the Final Four, this will be a good one for Bob, they became the first MVC team to advance that far since...
I hate trivia. I didn't know
it's
this
like
was,
your biggest I stick on the radio.
I didn't know this was going to be a trivia.
Sparking conversation.
The first Valley team since
to get to the final. Who was the Valley team before Wichita State in 2013 to get to the Final Four?
Paul.
Blue uniforms.
Indiana State with Larry Bird.
Indiana State, 1979.
That's a long time.
All right, that's the end of the trivia then. Give us a big picture description of that team. What made that Shocker team go, Bob?
Well, I'm gonna start with the guy that we don't talk about enough, in my opinion, and that's Clay Anthony Early. Not only was he the best player on this Final Four team, he was the best player on the next team that, in my opinion, was even a better team than this one. His career at Wichita State was short, but incredibly impactful. And I think his name belongs way up high when you're talking about players who made a difference with Wichita State basketball. To me, it's not a coincidence that they had this team and then a 35-0 team. Just think about that. Back to back, that's incredible. And while we celebrate this Final Four team, that team the next year deserves a pretty strong celebration as well. And this guy, I don't know that he's rafter worthy, but he's pretty heady stuff in my opinion.
Okay, Mike, I'll let you. But I was saving the Clay Anthony question for last. But
well,
yeah,
when I bring him up
as he needs to be in the rafters with Stallworth and Littleton and Livingston and Carr, sometimes people are hesitant or surprised. To me, there's no question that he deserves his jersey up there.
I personally wouldn't have. I think there's some others that are in that discussion. We don't need to get into that today. But the impact that Clay Anthony Early had on Shocker basketball, they don't go to a Final Four without him. They don't obviously have a 35-0 run without him. I just think I think he's kind of, I'll see if Mike agrees, he's sort of the forgotten guy in all of this.
Only here 2 years, but he did his 2 years. He's on the NCAA All-Tournament, All-Final-Four team. He's the only Wichita State player to ever have done that. He was an All-American NBA draft pick. I don't know what other boxes he would need to check to get up there. Ron Baker and Fred Van Fleet will obviously be up there at some point. I think he's absolutely deserving. Mike?
No, I can't disagree with anything that you guys have said. I think, you know, you don't remember him quite like it was, possibly because he didn't start a lot of games that year. He started about half the games, but yeah, huge impact. And then the other guy, and I don't think he's been overlooked necessarily, but again, just a one-year player in Malcolm Armstead. And I'll never forget the year before, that summer, the team was going to take a trip to South America, I think, Brazil or somewhere. And so they were able to have some extra practices in the middle of the summer, and I went in to watch him. That's the first time I saw Ron Baker. And he was playing in practice against David Kyle, who was a freak athlete, and not getting beat, not getting used up. And there was a break, and I called Greg Marshall over, and I said, are you kidding me? You got this guy to walk on? And he said, hey, our starting guards next year will probably be two guys that are paying their way to school this year. And it was Baker and Malcolm. And I hadn't seen Malcolm, but huge impact as a leader, helped develop Fred VanVleet, brought a little bit of confidence and swagger, I think, to that team that kind of fed over to everybody getting better.
Okay, Mike, we'll get back to big picture view of this team. What characterized this team?
I think that it was really almost two different teams. We talked about, I think before we started recording this, that the five guys that started the year as the starting lineup, at one point a few games in, 10 games in or so, four of those guys were out for some period of time, and they had to go through some major adjustments. Evan Wessel was gone for the year. Ron missed 20 games or something. And so there was this whole evolutionary process of figuring out who the lineup was, who was going to play. And then when Baker came back at the Valley Tournament, it transitioned again into the team that ended up making the run. So it was in some ways hard to get a feel for that team through the course of the year and just who they were and how good they were. And then it all came together at the perfect time.
It definitely had two or three different versions of that team. Carl Hall also missed significant time. Ahime missed a few games. So they had some interesting injury issues. So this team is interesting because we've talked about it endured some low points. What turned things around in March for this group? Bob, what's your memory of when they caught fire and why?
I just think their young players started to figure it out more. We knew they were talented guys, but they just started to figure it out more. They had that great mix of veteran leadership and young players. And they had a lot of guys who could contribute. They played really good defense from the start to the finish. That was kind of a calling card, obviously, with Greg Marshall's teams. So that really never went away for long. But I just think that they gelled. They're young guys. When you play 30-plus games and you get into February and March, you're not really young anymore. And I think their chemistry just came together.
And you know, we mentioned Clay Anthony. I mean, he was one of the, you'd have to consider him one of the young guys, too, one of the new guys. He came from, a Division III JUCO? So that's a big step up in competition. So he got better and better. And I think when Baker came back, it not only added offense in terms of his shooting, which helped a lot, but I couldn't help but notice right away, just even though he hadn't been playing, obviously watching and having been through it, just knowing where to go, where to cut, finding openings in the defense. He contributed a lot to the way the ball movement improved and so forth, just the overall composition of the offense down the stretch.
Yeah, his addition was definitely significant. I guess it shows us that if you have three NBA players on your team, that's pretty helpful. Pretty helpful. So in part because of those injuries, this team's depth was really on display, especially in the regular season. Ahime started the 30 games, as we mentioned, including two in the NCAA tournament. Patrick Williams started 26. He had a stretch where he was really important with Ron out, with Evan Wessel out. Nick Wiggins had some big games, 12 in a tight win over Southern Miss down at Intrust Arena. He had 18 at Drake. Jake White had some moments, especially versus Gonzaga. So Greg Marshall's team's always characterized by depth. How did this team utilize its depth? Mike?
Well, Bob mentioned the defense, and that was the biggest thing, I think. Everybody played defense, and I think everybody accepted their roles. I mean, Shadrach Lufiel was last on the team in scoring, but he had some moments in the NCAA. It seems like against Ohio State he had a couple of big plays, and just everybody kind of understood their role and contributed, and that's how they got through, having those guys out.
And you think back, everybody had big moments. Nick Wiggins made a lot of big shots that season, kind of a guy off the bench that they could really count on to give them kind of instant offense at times. You mentioned Jake White. I mean, you talk about a forgotten player. I didn't remember him until I looked at the stat sheet, but he had some moments. And then we haven't mentioned Tekel Cotton, who, my goodness, so what a glue guy he was. Maybe the best defensive player that's ever played here. I think he's in that argument. Athletic, a guy who could do incredible things on the basketball floor. You know, they had a lot of good players. You think back to that poor Wichita State team that went to the Final Four back in 1965 without Stallworth
and Bowman,
and how depleted that team was. This team was not depleted. They withstood some injuries, yes, but they had really solid depth.
Yeah, and really guys that could do what, as Mike said, what they were needed to do. Ahime blocking shots, protecting the rim. Demetric Williams, good defender, really an energy guy. Nick Wiggins, just a super, super athlete and could really get going on the scoring end, definitely. Bob, did you have a favorite player, one that maybe was enjoyable to talk to, had a compelling story? What would you remember about those interactions with them?
Well, I liked talking to Nick Wiggins. He was outgoing and effervescent and had a lot to say. And certainly Mike mentioned Fred VanVleet, and every time you talk to him, you're just like, you're just compelled to listen to every word. So those guys were great. Klee Anthony was kind of off the wall at times, fun to talk to.
Very talkative, yes.
Baker was never at a loss for words. They were a fun team to cover, as well as a fun team to watch, because those guys, they just had something special. Demetric Williams was good to talk with. They were all good interviews.
Yeah, and Mike, how about you?
Malcolm stands out to me. Just he was so mature, and very, very much team oriented. I mean, there are the stories that there were times when Fred was in the game and Marshall was going to put Malcolm back in, and he'd say, "Now give him a couple more minutes. He's playing well, you know. Give him, you know, let him play," and really helped his development. You know, I think some people would be, you know, reluctant when they see somebody that could potentially take their job to help him out the way he did, and he had a big role in Fred's development. So I always enjoyed talking to him. He always had a very mature perspective about what was going on.
And he's a guy who could have come here and wanted just to be pretty selfish, because he could have made it about him, because he was kind of on the run and moving around. And he ended up at Wichita State with, like Mike says, some guys that he could make an impression on, and he chose to do that rather than try to be the guy all to himself. I was impressed with him as well.
Yeah, definitely had a big role in that team. He had been at Oregon, had been at junior college with Greg Heyer, right?
Yes.
And that's how
yes.
he ultimately ended up here with Greg, the assistant coach. He is the one they say told coaches they were going to the Final Four early in that NCAA tournament run. Whether that's apocryphal or not, I don't know. But he had that swagger, as Mike said, that kind of confidence. Carl Hall, I remember part of the fun of being around these teams on a, you know, kind of a long, consistent basis. I think Carl was a guy who got more and more comfortable with us talking to people. And I remember because he cut his dreadlocks going into the NCAA tournament and really enjoyed the new hair, because people were making a big deal out of it. I think he brought the hair to a press conference at one point. It was just fun seeing those guys enjoy the spotlight. And I guess that would be a credit. That's one thing that stuck out to me. The coaching staff, Greg Marshall, allowed them to. They kind of soaked it all in. They, you know, it wasn't something. They were not Kentucky. They were not going every year, so they really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and, you know, you think back, and when we went out to Salt Lake and they played Pitt, and I think if memory serves, and my memory very rarely does, but I think they were a slight underdog in that game to Pitt, and they just took it to Pitt. And that's really where I, in myself, said, that's interesting. How good is this team? You knew they had the number one seed Gonzaga next. It certainly made that game more interesting, the way they just manhandled Pitt. I think the way they beat Pitt gave them a lot of confidence. Not that they didn't already have it, but they won that game by 18. And who was Pitt's main guy that...
Trey Woodall, talking about
Very good.
We had not mentioned Tate Kelcott maybe as much as we should have, but he was the star on defense in that day, definitely.
That game is one of my favorite memories of the whole thing, because on Selection Sunday, as soon as the bracket was announced, shortly afterward I got a call from a talk show in Pittsburgh. They wanted me to come on and talk about Wichita State. I said, sure. So I get on there, and it's just a bombardment. First of all, they were upset that Pitt only got an 8 seed. And how did this team get a 9 seed? Who have they beat? And I said, well, you know, DePaul, which the last time I checked is in your conference, and named some others. And it was just that type of put down through the whole thing. And finally at the end, they said, well, what do you think of Wichita State's chances? And I said, if the team's attitude is anything like what I've been hearing on the other end of this interview, I like their chances a lot. And when you mentioned to Cale, the thing I'll never forget was really early in the game, he just took it from Trey Woodall, and they went down and scored. And as Woodall's bringing the ball back up the floor, I swear, unless I missed it, Takeo never talked crap to anybody, never said anything. But he was down in his stance waiting for him, looking at him, and the look on his face was like, I've got you, and you know I've got you, and there's not a thing you can do about it. And he was in Trey Woodall's head big time that entire game.
Yes, that was, and there was a lot. I think it's, I don't know that Wichita State fans or maybe even us knew quite what to expect because of the way that team had played, you know, late February, lost in the Valley Tournament Championship game to Creighton. So, and then as you said, I think Pittsburgh was upset with its seeding. It was kind of an interesting circumstances that really helped the Shockers, no doubt.
You know, I think it needs to be said that one of the things that stood out about that run, Greg Marshall, maybe more than any other time in his tenure at Wichita State, kind of developed a knack for the right thing to say at just the right time that helped that team. You know, I was going to ask you guys if you remembered the play angry thing started with Antoine and X were at a home game, came in the locker room. It was about, should never let anybody beat you at home. You got to play angry. I don't even remember if that was that same season or maybe even the year before.
I think it was the Missouri State game after they had lost three in a row, I'm remembering. I think they're in the locker room before.
And that was mentioned. I'm sure you had it in your story and that sort of thing, but it didn't seem like it really got talked about a lot. And then Antoine called Greg before the game in Salt Lake City and said, you know, that was one of my homes. I played there. You got to remind the guys to play angry. And then it really started coming up. And then after they beat Pittsburgh at practice the next day, he asked them, are you satisfied? You know, is that enough? That was a good win. Are you satisfied? Which I thought was a great approach. And then I don't remember the exact time and score, but I remember being told that late in the Gonzaga game, they're down four or something. There's a timeout, and he said, if I told you at the beginning of the season you'd be down four to Gonzaga with X minutes to go to the Sweet 16, would you have taken it? And they all said, yes, of course, and let's go out and do it then. I mean, he really, through that whole thing, had a knack for getting them in the right frame of mind.
Yes, I thought he really shone on that stage for those reasons. He was in the press conference, you know, he would shout out, I think, you know, Pizza Hut, the Air Capital. He mentioned, I think, the volleyball team going to the Sweet 16. He just enjoyed the whole thing. I think that helped the team enjoy the whole thing. He was really good for his way for words really, really showed up on that big stage, no doubt.
And let's also point out here that, yeah, they lost in the semifinals. But they had Louisville on the ropes for most of that game. In fact, I can't remember the name of the kid from Louisville who came in and made a bunch of
Luke shots. Hancock.
Yeah.
Transfer from
George Mason.
Mason, yeah.
It all connects.
That's who you ought to do a podcast with. Where is Luke Hancock? Because that guy kind of ruined a lot of dreams. He made a lot of big shots in that game that overcame what I thought they were in.
Well, and there was another kid that had made like one or two threes all year that came off the bench and hit a couple of big shots for them.
Yeah, I envision him, some little guard.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they really played well against Louisville for most of that game, and that Louisville just made shots.
I went back and looked one time. I think Louisville won something like their last 16 games that year in that run to the national championship, and that was the closest game they had. And I think Pitino even said at one point, that was the best team we played in that run, and that was the toughest game we had in that whole stretch.
Most memorable game, Mike, which one sticks out?
Well, first, beyond the Final Four, or the NCAA tournament run, there was the game at Illinois State, and I went back and looked. They were down seven with 40 seconds to go. They'd actually missed a shot, down five with under a minute, and that was the Jackie Carmichael rebound where he kicked to Cale Cotton. And whatever anybody says, I've watched that replay a jillion times. You can see him look right at him and kick his foot at him. And the bench, there was a foul then on Wichita State, and the bench said, hey, look at that, you know. And when they looked, they assessed the flagrant. So they made two free throws to go up 7. Klee made 2 free throws to cut it to 5. Then Dimitrik made a 3, and Klee ended up hitting a 3. And then there was the incident in the locker room afterward that, you know, I've only heard, you know, secondhand. We weren't in there, of course, but in the tunnel out, or the hallway outside the locker room.
Between the coaches.
Yeah.
Dan Muller and Greg Marshall were not. There was a rivalry there.
Charge Greg Marshall. The other thing I've always heard about that is the players heard the commotion, were starting out of the locker room, and Dominique Acon stood in their way and said, get back in there. Nobody was going to challenge Dominic. But that was one of those rare, back, Bob will remember, back when in the early days of our coverage, there were a lot of two-game swings in the Valley where you'd go one place and day in between and go another. Well, we didn't do that much back then, but that particular trip, we played Illinois State and then bussed over the next day to Terre Haute and played Indiana State on the same trip. And on the bus over, Greg Marshall is going up and down the aisle of the bus. There was a 70s song called Kung Fu Fighting, and he's singing, everybody was kung fu fighting, and he'd do the karate kick, and he knew every word to the song. You remember every word to that song, so that was pretty comical.
Yeah, that big game, Shockers won that one 68-67, scored 8 points in the final 40 seconds of that game. Quite a memorable regular season game. Bob, how about you, most memorable game?
Well, it has to be the Gonzaga game, right? I mean, that was the one that defined the Shockers' season, in my opinion, because they beat the number one seed. And that woke everybody up to wait a minute, what's Wichita State doing in this situation? Then they went to L.A., and I thought they got a good draw. I mean, they get to play LaSalle. I mean, I think the three of us and two janitors here could have beaten LaSalle. Not really, but LaSalle was a good draw. And while Ohio State was a really good team, they were a beatable team. I don't think anybody was that shocked that Wichita State went to Los Angeles and beat LaSalle and Ohio State. So some of it was, they had some teams knocked out that was helpful to them. But the Gonzaga win, my goodness, you beat a number one seed and a worthy number one seed. To me, that's not only the defining win of that season, but one of the three or four in Shocker basketball history.
And there are a couple of things about that game. When I mentioned the Illinois State game, I said outside the NCAA tournament run, I would also pick Gonzaga. The shot that Fred made late in the game, a couple of steps beyond the three-point line, and launched it. I heard he even turned to the bench and winked after he let it go, But I called it in the play-by-play, one of the biggest shots in Wichita State history. And then after the game, the bench was at one end of the floor. The fans that were there were behind the bench. And then the band was right around the corner at the end of the floor. And the band started playing that You Don't Want to Go to War with the Shockers. And the players and coaches all lined up on the end line and were dancing around and singing that song. And it was, of all everything that happened to me, that was maybe the single most spontaneous, joyous moment of the entire run through the tournament.
I think Fred's answer, because he's been asked about that, I think Greg had been on him about when are you going to make a big shot or those kind of things, you know, kind of that pushing the buttons that Greg liked to do, and that was Fred's response. Yeah, so let me remind you, the Gonzaga game, 76-70, Baker and Klee Anthony both had 16 points. I thought Carl Hall really had a important game from establishing that Wichita State was physically tougher team. Not great stats, but I just thought he had a really, really important part in that. And then Fred had 13 in that game, so definitely a little bit of a coming out party for Fred.
It'd be fun to talk to Fred about that game because his numbers, we all saw him play. We knew he was a good player and we thought he'd be a really good player, but his numbers this season we're talking about were nothing really to write home about. But making that shot and then what he did the following year where he really took it to a new level, I'm just wondering about the importance in his basketball life of that shot against Gonzaga going down, not to make too much of it, but I wonder what he'd say about that.
And even carrying over, you know, he made a couple of big plays down the stretch in the Ohio State game, too, that I think probably had some carryover confidence benefit from making that shot.
One of the most striking things about that next season when they went 35-0 was, you know, entering the season, the natural question was, you're losing Malcolm Armstead. Who plays point? It's probably Fred, but there was absolute confidence. You could have talked to all of the assistant coaches, everyone on that team. There was no question that Fred was ready for that, and clearly he was. Greg Marshall, why was he the coach that could get that team to do those kind of things?
I don't know. I mean, if you could bottle it, you'd probably make a lot of money. But he just had, like Mike said, he knew what to say and when to say it. He could motivate. He had a good understanding of, especially of the concept of defense. He really demanded that. And every coach will say, I'm going to demand that you play defense. But we know that's a facade in many cases. With him, it wasn't. You had to play defense. And this team was really good defensively. All his teams were really good defensively. And I think they rode that ability to play defense and score enough. I mean, they didn't average 70 points a game this year, the final 4 years. But they scored enough to be successful, but they relied on defense, and that's something he preached day in and day out. And when he demanded it, it was different than when most coaches demand it.
I think he had a sense from the beginning, having been at places like College of Charleston and Winthrop, that even at Wichita State, when you got to that level, you weren't going to out-talent people. That defense and toughness and playing together were ways that a program like Wichita State could beat some of the blue bloods. And then, of course, he did have, you know, ended up 3 NBA players, as you mentioned. He had good players, but always they put themselves in position to win through the defense that Bob was talking about and that toughness and playing together, beating people on the floor for loose balls, all those little things that add up to big things. And he just had a feel for that's how we're going to have to play if we're going to beat some of these people.
Not turning the ball over. They always won that math, that possession battle. What I will always remember about watching practices and how that pertained to the success is his energy in practices. He would sit in the middle, he would stand in the middle of that court, and people would be flying by him, and he had a great memory.
Yeah.
He could stop things and say, all right, 5 possessions ago, you were here when you should have been 3 feet over, and you set this screen, and the timing wasn't right, and he was always right. He always remembered. But those practices, the word I always used was crackled. There was an energy and an intensity in those practices. And a lot of players say this, but I think there was a lot of truth to it, that the games were in some ways easier than the practices. I think that was a big part of what made those teams successful. All right. We already talked about Clay Anthony early in the rafters. I think we're unanimous on that. Final thoughts, Bob. Have we missed anything? What else would you like to get in about that season?
Well, we talked a lot about the team and about our personal experiences with covering a Final Four. I have been to numerous Final Fours, only one with the Shockers. So that one was extremely memorable. As I said, being on the road with my son and covering Wichita State and the hometown team, it was more special than maybe being out there with KU, which I've done numerous times, or other Final Fours. So just that team, you know, it was a special team. But I'll say it again, I hope that in a year you're doing a podcast on the next team that came along, because I don't want that team to be undersold. That was an incredible basketball team that went 35-0 and played Kentucky to the wire. And to me, that I think that team and the 63-64 team are the two best Shocker teams in history. I'm curious to know what Mike thinks about that. And this Final Four team certainly would be in that realm as well. But Boy, what a 2-year stretch for Wichita State.
I'm already working on the trivia questions for the 2014 retrospective, no doubt. Up. Yes.
Bob's comments about the 14 and the 63-64 team, I would certainly agree with. I'd put the 80-81 team in that list too, and you know, that team reached the Elite Eight without Ozell Jones and with Tony Martin kind of hobbled for a while in the tournament. So that was a great team also. But I guess for me, it's just I hope that I experience something like this again before I retire, which may not be too long, but it was just such a special memory. And it was, I think you can take a lot of pride if you were part of it, in just the people that were involved. We've talked about the qualities of those players and the coaching staff, and to watch somebody that didn't have those McDonald's All-Americans and all that kind of stuff go as far as they did, in my opinion, should have been in the championship game. That held ball with Baker was crap, and I'll always feel that way. But yeah, it'll just always be a really, really special memory for me. Absolutely unforgettable, no matter what else happens from here on.
Definitely a lot of fun. I think my big memory is coming back briefly in between rounds and just seeing how on fire the city was, the fans, and hearing the story, the fireworks after games, and people just being so excited, and T-shirts flying off the shelves. All those things was really a lot of fun to observe.
Yeah, I think all of us who have been around here a long time, I've always had that feeling that there's nothing that ignites this city like Shocker basketball when it's successful. And I think that's true. I mean, it reached across all kinds of backgrounds and everything else, and people that weren't even that, you know, that intense basketball fans that just got into it, and the T-shirt sales and all the stuff all over town was just absolutely incredible.
Mike made a good point on the 80-81 team, too. You could do a series of podcasts. That was some kind of team. And you talk about the personalities on that team. Well, off the charts.
Interesting time, no doubt. Bob, give us a League 42 update. You've wrapped up or about to wrap up another season. You have the new, Leslie Rudd Learning Center. Uh-huh. Give us the League 42 update.
Well, we're as busy as we've ever been. We're adding all kinds of stuff to the baseball part of this, education and other programming. So serving 600 kids, and we're flying high right now, Paul.
Okay. It's a big week.
Unsolicited, sorry, let me
go ahead, Mike, yes.
And I've always said, I've told you guys this, I think you guys are great writers. I think that at your time during the Eagle, you were the best there was. But for Bob to find this niche and to hit on something that has done so much for so many kids is just an accomplishment that very few people. I mean, you know, they say if you can affect one person's life, you've done something to make the world better. And you look at what Bob's done with this thing, it's going to be his legacy, and I think it's tremendous.
League 42, so it's baseball, youth baseball for kids who might not have that opportunity to participate in baseball. How many kids do you have in your in the program?
Way too many. Okay. 600.
600.
So, yeah, we capped our league at 600. That's how many we feel comfortable serving, and they're great kids, and they're getting a lot out of this programming, we hope, and we love doing it.
So League 42 has a website if you want to get involved. You're always looking for coaches. You're always looking for volunteers. Yes, as Mike said, Bob's transition from cynical, curmudgeonly sports columnist to the kindly grandfather of baseball in Wichita has just been a great thing to see. Hey, thank you both very much. It was a lot of fun reminiscing about that team. It's a big week for basketball in Wichita. We're talking all this Final Four talk because the Aftershocks open play in the basketball tournament on July 20th. Shocker alumni reunion from the Final Four team. That portion of the weekend is highlighted by the dinner at Mark Arts on July 22nd. Thanks very much.
Hi, this is Rick Muma, president of Wichita State University. Check out the latest episode of the Forward Together podcast. Each episode, I sit down with different guests from Shocker Nation to celebrate the vision and mission of Wichita State University. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Roundhouse Podcast, courtesy of Wichita State University Strategic Communications. We encourage you to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. You can find more Roundhouse content at GoShockers.com.
It's over! It is over! Ladies and gentlemen, say it slowly and savor it. Wichita State is going to the Final Four for the first time in 48 years.
Unbelievable. What a scene, folks. The Shocker fans are just going crazy in the stands.
Just maybe the greatest win in the history of Wichita State basketball.